We walked along silently for a little while, strolling up and down the length of this wide place, occasionally passing others who were taking the opportunity to get a little bit of exercise. We happened upon Fra Jad, who was walking alone. I decided that now was the moment. "Fra Leo," I said. "Fra Jad has informed me that the millenarian math at Sant Edhar is one of three places where the secular power put all of its nuclear waste around the time of the reconstitution. The other two are Rambolf and Tredegar. Both of them were illuminated last night by a laser from the cousin's ship." Leo wasn't as surprised by this as I'd hoped.
"Among Fendant types, there is a suspicion that the Three Inviolates were allowed to remain unsacked for a reason. One hypothesis is that they are dumps for everything killers and other dangerous leftovers of the Praxic Age."
"Please, you speak of my home. Don't call it a dump," Fra Jad said.
But he was amused, not offended. He was being, if I could say this of a thousander, playful.
"Have you seen the stuff?"
Leo asked.
"Oh, yes. It is in cylinders, in a cavern in the rock. We see it every day."
"Why?"
"Various reasons. For example, my avocation is Thatcher."
"I don't recognize the word," I said.
"It is an ancient profession, one who makes roofs out of grass."
"What possible application could that have in a nuclear waste repository?
Condensation forms on the ceiling of the cavern and drips onto the tops of the cylinders. Over thousands of years it could corrode them, or, just as bad, form stalagmites whose weight would crush and rupture the containers. We have always maintained thatched roofs atop the cylinders to prevent this from happening."
This was all so weird that I couldn't think of anything to do other than to continue making polite chatter.
"Oh, I see. Where do you get the grass? You don't have much room to grow grass up there, do you?"
"We don't need much. A properly made thatching lasts for a long time. I have yet to replace all of those that were put in place by my fid, Sir Averdale, a century ago."
Leo and I both walked on for a few paces before this hit us. Then we exchanged a look and wordlessly agreed not to say anything.
"He was just having us on," I said, the next time Leo and I could speak privately, which was at the retreat center, as we were dropping our bags in the cell we were to share.
"He was getting back at us for calling his math a dump." Leo said nothing.
"Leo, he's not that old."
Leo put his bag down, stood up straighter than I could, and rotated his shoulders down and back, which was a way of recovering his equilibrium, as if he could defeat opponents just through superior posture.
"Let's not worry about how old he is."
"You think he is that old?"
"I said let's not worry about it."
"I don't think we have to worry about it, but it would be interesting to know."
"Interesting."
Leo did the shoulder thing again.
"Look, we're both talking bullshit. Would you agree?"
"Yeah, I agree," I said immediately.
"Enough of this. We have to talk straight. And then we have to shut up if we don't want to get burned at the stake."
"Okay. You see this from a Fendant point of view. I take your point."
"Good. So we both know what we're really talking about now."
"That you can't live that long without repairing the sequences in the nuclei of your cells," I said.
"Especially if you work around radiation."
I hadn't thought of that. I pondered it for a moment, replaying the earlier conversation with Jad. How could he have possibly made such a slip? He must know how dangerous it is even to hint that he is, the sort of person who could do things like repairing his own cells.
"Are you kidding? It wasn't a slip. It was deliberate, Raz."
"He was letting us know."
"He was entrusting us with his life," Leo said. "Haven't you noticed how he was sizing everyone up today? He chose us, my Fra."
"Wow. If that's really true, I'm honored."
"Well, enjoy being honored while you can," Leo said, "because that kind of honor doesn't come without obligations."
"What kind of obligations are you thinking of?"
"How should I know? I'm just saying that he was evoked for a reason. He's expected to do something. He's starting to develop a strategy, and we're part of that strategy now. Soldiers. Pawns."
This shut me up for a little while. I could hardly think straight.
Then I remembered something that somehow made it easier. We were already pawns anyway, I said.
Yeah, and given the choice, I'd rather be a pawn of someone I can see, Leo said.
And then he smiled the old Leo smile for the first time since last night. He had been more serious than I'd ever seen him, but the sight of those kills, if that was what they were, lined up on that ship, had given him a lot to be serious about. We of out like to tell ourselves that we lived in a humble and austere manner, by contrast with Bayesian prelates who strutted around in silk robes, enveloped in clouds of incense. But at least our buildings were made out of stone and didn't need a lot of upkeep. This place was all wooden. Higher up the slope, a little ark and a ring of barracks that formed a sort of cloister, centered on a spring. Down closer to the road, two rows of cells with bunk beds and a large building with a dining hall and a few meeting rooms. The buildings were well taken care of, but it was obvious that they were in continual decay and that if the people were to leave, the place would be a pile of kindling in a few decades. We did not get to see how the monks lived. The cells where we stayed were clean but covered with graffiti scratched into the walls and bunks by the kids who came here by the coachload during the summer. It was just dumb luck that no kids were there when we arrived. One group had departed a couple of days earlier, and another was expected soon. Of the half-dozen young adults who staffed the place, four had gone back to town during the break. The remaining two, and the Bayesian priest who was in charge of the retreat center, had prepared a simple meal for us. After we had deposited our bags in our cells and spent a few minutes cleaning up in the communal bathrooms, we convened in the dining hall and sat down at rows of folding tables, much like the ones we used at Appert. The place smelled of art supplies. The monks, we were told, numbered 43, which seemed like a small figure to us avowed for whom a chapter was 100 strong. Four of them came down to dine with us. It wasn't clear whether they had special status, like hierarchs, or were simply the only ones of the 43 who had any curiosity about us. All of them were graybeards and all wanted to meet Fra Jad. Bayesian Orthodox clerical Orth was about 70% the same as what we spoke. After the exchange that Leo and I just had, you might think we'd have wanted to sit next to Fra Jad, but in fact we had the opposite reaction and ended up sitting as far away from him as we could, as if we were secret agents in a spiele, making a big point of preserving our cover, playing it cool. At the last minute, Archibald hustled in with several of the hunters. They had been running a calca in one of the cabins. He had a wild look about him, desperate to talk. He had not been able to examine the photomnemonic tablet until late in the day. Now he had seen the geometry proof blazoned on the cousin's ship, and he was about to explode. I felt sorry for him when he came into the dining hall and found himself forced to choose between sitting with me and Leo, or with Fra Jad and the Bayesian monks. Furman Beller, noting his indecision, stood up and beckoned him over. Archibald couldn't decline the invitation without giving offense, so he went and sat with Furman. We always opened our meals by invoking the memory of Sant Cartas. The gist of it was that our minds might be nourished by all manner of ideas originating from thinkers dating all the way back to Canoas. But for the physical nourishment of our bodies, we relied upon one another, joined in the discipline that we owed to Cartas. Diolaters, on the other hand, all had different pre-meal rituals. Bayesian Orthodoxy was a post-agrarian religion in which literal sacrifice had been replaced by symbolic. They opened their meals with a reenactment and effigy of that, then praised their god for a while, then asked him for goods and services. The priest who ran the retreat center launched into it out of habit, but got unnerved in the middle when he noticed that none of the avowed were bowing their heads, just gazing at him curiously. I didn't think he was all that troubled by our not believing what he believed. He must have been used to that. He was more embarrassed that he'd committed a faux pas. So when he was finished, he implored us to say whatever sort of blessing or invocation might be traditional in the math. As mentioned, we were strangely lacking in sopranos and altos, but we were able to put together enough tenors, baritones, and basses to sing a very ancient and simple invocation of Cartas. Fra Jad handled the drone, and I could swear he made the silverware buzz on the tables. The four monks seemed to enjoy this very much, and when we'd finished, they stood up and did an equally ancient-sounding prayer. It must have dated back to the early centuries of their monastic age,
just after the fall of Baz, because their old Orth was indistinguishable from ours, and it had obviously been composed in a time before the music of the Maths and of the monasteries had diverged. If you didn't listen too carefully to the words, you could easily mistake this piece for one of ours. The conversation during the meal had to be superficial compared to the events of the last 24 hours, given that we had to talk in Fluckish and couldn't mention the ship in earshot of our hosts. I became frustrated, then bored, then drowsy, and ate mostly in silence. Cord and Rosk talked to each other. They weren't religious, and I could tell they felt awkward here. One of the young women on the staff made lavish efforts to make them feel welcome, which mostly backfired. Saman was absorbed in his Jija, which he had somehow patched into the retreat center's communication system. Barb had found a list of the camp rules and was memorizing it. Our 300ers sat in a cluster and talked amongst themselves. They could not speak Fluckish and didn't have the thousander glamour that had made Fra Jad the center of attention with the Bayesian monks. I noticed that Arcibald was deep in conversation with Furman, and that Cord and Rosk had shifted closer to them. So I wandered over to see what they were talking about. It seemed that Furman had been thinking about the Skonix and wanted to know more. Arcibald, for lack of any other way to pass the time, had launched into a calca called The Fly, the Bat, and the Worm, which was a traditional way of explaining the Skonic theory of time and space to Fids.
"Look at that fly crawling around on the table," Arcibald said. "No, don't shoo it away. Just look at it. The size of its eyes."
Furman Beller gave it a quick glance and then returned his eyes to his dinner.
"Yeah, half of its body seems to be eyes.
Thousands of separate eyes, actually. It doesn't seem as though it could possibly work."
Arcibald reached back behind himself and waved his hand around, nearly hitting me in the face.
"Yet if I wave my hand back here, far away, it doesn't care. Knows there is no threat. But if I bring my hand closer..."
Arcibald brought his hand forward. The fly took off.
"Somehow its microscopic brain takes signals from thousands of separate primitive eyes and integrates them into a correct picture, not merely of space, but of space-time. It knows where my hand is. Knows that if my hand keeps moving thus, it'll soon squash it. So it had better change its position."
"You think the cousins have eyes like that?"
Beller asked. Arcibald dodged sideways.
"Maybe they're like bats instead. A bat would have detected my hand by listening for echoes."
Beller shrugged.
"All right. Maybe the cousins squeak like bats.
On the other hand, when I shift my body to swat the fly, it creates a pattern of vibrations in the table that a creature, even a deaf and blind one, such as a worm, might feel."
"Where is this going?"
Beller asked.
"Let's do a thought experiment," Arcibald said. "Consider a proton fly. By that, I mean the pure, ideal form of a fly."
"Meaning what?"
"All eyes. No other sense organs."
"All right. I'm considering it,"
Beller said, trying to be good-humored. "Now, a proton bat."
"All ears?"
"Yes."
"Now a proton worm."
"Meaning all touch?"
"Yes. No eyes, ears, or nose, just skin."
"Are we going to do all five senses?"
"It would start to become boring, so let's stop with three," Arcibald said. "We place the fly, the bat, and the worm in a room with some object, let's say a candle. The fly sees its light. The bat squeals at it and hears its echoes. The worm feels its warmth and can crawl over it to feel its shape."
"It sounds like the old parable of the six blind men and the..."
"No," said Arcibald. "This is completely different. Almost the opposite. The six blind men all have the same sensory equipment."
Beller nodded, seeing his mistake.
"Yeah, but the fly, the bat, and the worm have different ones.
And the six blind men disagree about what it is they are groping."
"But the fly, the bat, and the worm agree?"
Beller asked, raising an eyebrow.
You sound skeptical. Rightly so. But they are all sensing the same object, are they not?"
"Sure,"
Beller said.
"But when you say that they agree with each other, I don't know what that means."
"It's a fascinating question, so let's explore it. Let's change the rules a little.
said Archibald. Just to set the stakes a little higher and make it so that they have to agree. The thing in the middle of the room isn't a candle. Now it's a trap.
A trap?
Beller laughed. Archibald got a proud look.
What's the point of that?
Beller asked. Now there's a threat, you see. They have to figure out what it is or they'll be caught.
Why not a hand coming down to swat them?
I thought of that, Archibald admitted. But we have to make allowances for the poor worm who senses things very slowly compared to the other two.
Well,
Beller said,
I expect they're all going to be caught in the trap sooner or later.
They are very intelligent, Archibald put in.
Still,
all right then. It is a huge cavern swarming with millions of flies, bats, and worms. Thousands of traps are scattered about the place. When a trap catches or kills a victim, the tragedy is witnessed by many others who learn from it. Beller considered it for a while as he served himself some more vegetables. After a while, he said,
Well, I expect that where you're going with it is that once enough time has gone by and enough of these critters have been caught, the flies will learn what a trap looks like, the bats what it sounds like, the worm what it feels like.
The traps are being placed by exterminators who are intent on killing everything. They keep disguising them and coming up with new designs.
All right,
Beller said.
Then the flies, bats, and worms have to get clever enough to detect traps that are disguised.
A trap could look like anything, Archibald said. So they must learn to look at any object in their environment and to puzzle out whether or not it could possibly function as a trap.
Okay.
Now, some of the traps are suspended from strings. The worms can't reach them or feel their vibrations.
Too bad for the worms,
Beller said. The flies can't see anything at night.
Poor flies.
Some parts of the cavern are so noisy that the bats can't hear a thing.
Well, it sounds as though the flies, the bats, and the worms have better learned to cooperate with one another,
Beller said. How? This was the sound of Archibald's trap closing on his leg.
By communicating, I guess.
Oh? And what exactly does the worm say to the bat?
What does all of this have to do with the cousins?
Beller asked. It has everything to do with them.
You think that the cousins are hybrid fly-bat-worm creatures?
No, Archibald said. I think that we are.
Oh!
Beller cried, to laughter from everyone. Archibald threw up his hands as if to say, How could I make this any clearer?
Please explain,
Beller said.
I'm not used to this. My brain's getting tired.
No, you explain. What does the worm say to the bat?
The worm can't even talk.
This is a side issue. The worms learn over time that they can squirm around into different shapes that the bats and flies can recognize.
Fine. And, let me see, the flies could fly down and crawl around on the worms' backs and give them signals that way, etc. So I guess that each type of critter could invent signals that the other two could detect. Worm-bat, bat-fly, and so on.
Agreed. Now, what do they say to each other?
Well, hold on now, Archibald. You're skipping over a bunch of stuff. It's one thing to say a worm can squirm into a shape like C or S that could be recognized by a fly looking down, but that's an alphabet, not a language.
Archibald shrugged. But languages develop over time. Monkeys hooting at each other developed into some primitive speech. There's a snake under that rock, and so forth.
Well, that's fine, if snakes and rocks is all you have to talk about.
The world in this thought experiment, Archibald said, is a vast, irregular cavern sprinkled with traps. Some freshly laid and still dangerous, others that have already been sprung and may safely be ignored.
You went out of your way to say that they were mechanical contraptions. Are you saying they're predictable?
You or I could inspect one and figure out how it worked.
Well, in that case, it comes down to saying this gear here engages with that gear, which rotates yonder shaft, which is connected to a spring, and so on.
Archibald nodded. Yes. That's the sort of thing the flies, bats, and worms would have to communicate to one another in order to figure out what was a trap and what wasn't.
All right. So, same way that monkeys and trees settled on words for rock and snake, they develop symbols, words, meaning shaft, gear, and so on.
Would that be enough? Archibald asked.
Not for a complicated piece of clockwork. Let's see, you could have two gears that were close to each other, but they couldn't engage each other unless they were close enough for their teeth to mesh.
Proximity? Distance? Measurement? How would the worm measure the distance between two shafts?
By stretching from one to the other.
What if they were too far apart?
By crawling from one to the other and keeping track of the distance it moved.
The bat?
Timing the difference in echoes between the two shafts.
The fly?
Well, for the fly, it's easy. Compare the images coming into its eyes.
Very well. Let's say that the worm, the bat, and the fly have each observed the distance between the two shafts, just as you said. How do they compare notes?
The worm, for example, would tell what it knew by translating it into the squirming alphabet you mentioned.
And what does a fly say to another fly upon seeing all of this?
I don't know.
It says the worm seems to be relating some kind of account of its wormy doings, but since I don't squirm on the ground and can't imagine what it would be like to be blind, I haven't the faintest idea what it's trying to tell me.
Well, this is just what I was saying earlier,
Beller complained.
They have to have a language, not just an alphabet.
Archibald asked, what is the only sort of language that could possibly serve? Beller thought for a minute. What are they trying to convey to each other? Archibald prompted him.
Three-dimensional geometry, Beller said. And since parts of the clock are moving, you'd also need time.
Everything that a worm could possibly say to a fly, or a fly to a bat, or a bat to a worm would be gibberish, Archibald said, leading Beller forward.
Kind of like saying blue to a blind man.
Blue to a blind man, except for descriptions of geometry and of time. That is the only language that these creatures could ever possibly share.
This makes me think of that geometry proof on the cousin's ship,
Beller said.
Are you saying that we are like the worms and the cousins are like the bats? That geometry is the only way we can speak to each other?
Oh, no, Archibald said. That's not where I was going at all.
Where are you going, then?
Beller asked. You know how multicellular life evolved?
Single-celled organisms clumping together for mutual advantage?
Yes, and in some cases, encapsulating one another.
I've heard of the concept.
That is what our brains are.
What?
Our brains are flies, bats, and worms that clumped together for mutual advantage. These parts of our brains are talking to each other all the time, translating what they perceive moment to moment into the shared language of geometry. That's what a brain is. That's what it is to be conscious. Beller spent a few seconds mastering the urge to run away screaming, then a few minutes pondering this. Archibald watched him closely the whole time.
You don't mean literally that our brains evolved that way,
Beller protested. Of course not.
Huh, that's a relief.
But I put it to you, Furman, that our brains are functionally indistinguishable from ones that evolved thus.
Because our brains have to be doing that kind of processing all the time, just
in order for us to be conscious. To integrate our sensory perceptions into a coherent model of ourselves and our surroundings.
Is this that sconic stuff you were talking about earlier?
Archibald nodded. To a first approximation, yes. It is post-sconic. Certain metatheoricians who had been strongly influenced by the sconics came up with arguments like this one later, around the time of the first harbinger, which was a bit more detail than Furman Beller really wanted to hear, but Archibald's eyes flicked in my direction as if to confirm what I'd been suspecting. He had been reading up on this kind of thing as part of his research into the work that Evan Edrick had pursued later in his life. I lingered on the edge of that dialogue until it started to wind down. Then I got up and headed straight for my bunk, planning to sleep good and hard. But Archibald, moving uncharacteristically fast, chased me out of the dining hall and ran me down.
"What's on your mind?" I asked him.
"Some of the hunters held a little calca just before dinner.
I noticed.
They couldn't get the numbers to add up."
"Which numbers?"
"That ship simply isn't big enough to travel between star systems in a reasonable amount of time. It can't possibly hold a sufficient number of atomic bombs to accelerate its own mass to relativistic velocity."
"Well," I said, "maybe it split off from a mothership that we haven't seen yet, and that is that big."
It doesn't look like it's that kind of vessel, Arcibalt said. It is huge, with space to support tens of thousands of people indefinitely.
Too big to be a shuttle, too small for interstellar cruising, I said.
Precisely.
Seems like you are making a lot of assumptions, though.
That is a fair criticism, he said with a shrug.
But I could tell he had some other hypothesis. Okay, what do you think? I asked him.
I think it is from another cosmos, he said.
And that is why they evoked Paphlagon.
We were at the door of my cabin.
This cosmos we're living in has me flummoxed, I said. I don't know whether I can start thinking about additional ones at this point in the day.
Good night, then, Erasmus.
Good night, Arcibalt.
I woke to the sound of bells. I couldn't make sense of them. Then I remembered where I was and understood that they were not our bells, but those of the monks, rousing them for some punishingly early ritual. My mind was about half sorted out. Many of the new ideas, events, people, and images that had come at me from every direction the day before had been squared away, like so many leaves rolled up and thrust into pigeonholes. Not that anything had really been settled. All of the questions that had been open when my head had hit the pillow were still pending. But in the intervening hours, my brain had been changing to fit the new shape of my world. I guess that's why we can't do anything else when we're sleeping. It's when we work hardest. The peals faded slowly until I couldn't tell whether I was hearing the bells themselves or ringing in my ears. Enduring was a deep tone, solid, steady, but faint because distant. I knew somehow that I'd been hearing it for hours, that in those moments of semi-waking when I'd rolled over or pulled up the covers, I had marked this sound and wondered what it was before falling back to sleep. An obvious guess would be some nocturnal bird, but the tone was low, for an avian throat, like someone playing a 10-foot-long flute half-choked with rocks and water. And birds tended not to just sit in one place and make noise for half the night. Some kind of big amphibian, then, crazy for a mate, squatting on a rock by the spring and blowing wind through a quivering air sac. But the sound was regular, patterned. Perhaps the hum from a generator, an irrigation pump down in the valley, trucks descending a grade using air brakes. Curiosity and a full bladder were keeping me awake. Finally, I got up, moving quietly so as not to disturb Leo, and tugged at my blanket. Out of habit, I was going to wrap it around myself. Then I hesitated, remembering that I was supposed to wear Extramuros clothes. In the pre-dawn gloom, I couldn't even see the pile of trousers and underwear and whatnot I had left on the floor last night. So I went back to plan A, peeled the blanket off the bed, wrapped it around myself, and went out. The sound seemed to come from everywhere at once. But by the time I had used the latrine and emerged into the cool morning air, I had started to get a good idea of where it came from. A stone retaining wall that the monks had built along a steep part of the mountain to prevent their road from crumbling into the valley. As I walked toward it, my perceptions cleared suddenly, and I shook my head in amazement at my own silliness in having imagined it was an amphibian or a truck. It was plainly a human voice, singing, or rather droning, for he had been stuck on the same note the whole time I'd been awake. The note changed slightly. Okay, so it wasn't a drone, it was a chant. A very, very slow one. Not wanting to stroll right up to Frajad and disturb him, I maneuvered around on the soft, wet grass of the retreat center's archery range until I was able to bring him in view at a distance of a couple of hundred feet. The retaining wall ran in straight segments, joined by round, flat-topped towers about 4 feet in diameter. Fra Jad had rescued his bolt from his luggage, plumped it up to winter thickness, and put it on, then climbed to the top of a pillar that had a fine view to the south across the desert. He was sitting there with his legs tucked under him and his arms outstretched. Off to the left, the sky was luminescent purplish, washed of stars. To the right, a few bright stars and a planet still shone, striving against the light of the coming day, succumbing one by one as the minutes went by. I could have stood there, watching and listening for hours. I got the idea, which might have been just my imagination, that Fra Jed was singing a cosmographical chant, a requiem for the stars that were being swallowed up in the dawn. Certainly it was music of cosmographical slowness. Some of the notes went on for longer than I could hold my breath. He must have some trick of breathing and singing at the same time. A single bell rang behind and above me at the monastery. A priest's voice sang an invocation in Old Orth. A choir answered him. It was a call to the Dawn Aught, or something. I was crestfallen that their rituals were trampling on Fra Jad's chant. But I had to admit that if Cord had been awake to see this, she'd have been hard put to see any difference between the two. Whatever Fra Jad was chanting was rooted, I knew, in thousands of years' theoretical research, wedded to a musical tradition as old and as deep. But why put theorics into music at all? And why stay up all night, sitting in a beautiful place, chanting that music? There were easier ways to add 2 plus 2. I had been singing bass since the eventful season 6 years ago when I had fallen down the stairs from soprano. Where I lived, that meant lots of droning. When you spend 3 hours singing the same note, something happens to your brain. And that goes double when you have fallen into oscillatory lockstep with the others around you, and when you collectively have gotten your vocal cords tuned into the natural harmonics of the minster, to say nothing of the thousands of casks stacked against its walls. In all seriousness, I believe that the physical vibration of your brain by sound waves creates changes in how the brain works. And if I were a craggy old thousander, not a 19-year-old tenor, I might just have the confidence to assert that when your brain is in that state, it can think things it could never think otherwise. Which is a way of saying that I didn't think Fra Jad had been up all night chanting just because he was a music lover. He was doing something. I left Fra Jad alone and went for a stroll while the sun came up. Clatters and hisses from the dining hall told me that the retreat center staff were up making breakfast, so I went to the cell and put on my extra costume, then went there to lend a hand. In some respects, I might be helpless extramuros, but I knew how to cook. Fra Jad and the rest of our group drifted in one by one and tried to help until they were ejected and commanded to eat. In addition to the 4 who had dined with us the night before, 3 more monks joined us for breakfast, including 1 very old one who wanted to talk to Fra Jad, though he was quite hard of hearing. The rest of the avowed left them alone. These monks seemed to consider it a high honor to talk to a thousander, and so why should we interfere? They weren't going to get another chance. At the end of the meal, they presented us with some books. I let Arcibald accept them and make a nice speech. They liked what he said so much that it made me squirm a little, because it seemed he was encouraging them to see all sorts of natural connections between who we were and who they were. But no harm came of it. These people had been good to us, and they had done it with open hearts and no expectation of anything in return. I was pretty sure the secular power wasn't going to reimburse them. That's why Arcibald's talk made me uneasy. He seemed to hold out the possibility that they would get something in return, namely, future contact between them and us. I stepped on his toe. He seemed to take my meaning. A few minutes later, we were on our way down the mountain, the monk's books having been added to Arcibald's portable library.
Erasmus, a Fra at Sant Berytos in the 14th century AR, who, along with Sir Uthentine, founded the branch of metatheorics called complex protism. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR 3000.
Between the monastery and Bly's Butte, a very small river trickled through a very large canyon. Only one extant bridge spanned it. Until we had crossed this and come to a fork, we didn't need to think very hard about which direction we ought to go. The road to the left swung wide to avoid the mountain. The one to the right headed up the bank of a tributary toward a settlement marked on the cartabla as Samble. So we went that way, and a little more than an hour after leaving the monastery, found ourselves approaching something that, from a distance, looked like a pot scour dropped on the smooth southern flank of Bly's Butte. It was a carpet of scrubby trees. As we got closer, we saw it had been cleaved and sorted by settlers' walls, roofs, and fences. Taller trees, obviously fawned over by generations who loved them for shade or beauty, stood in a rectangle around a plot of grass, at one end of which rose the acute wood-framed sky altar of a Counterbasian arch. Without any communication between the two vehicles, we found our way to that village green. When we climbed out, we heard singing from the arch, but we saw no people. The entire town, including Ganeliel Crade, whose fetch was parked in a patch of dirt behind the arch, was inside that building. This didn't seem like a good place to look for Orlo, or, assuming he was still alive, Estimard. But it did give us our first hint as to how a couple of ferals might have been able to survive out here, by coming down into Samble to get things like food and medicine. How they might have paid for them was another question. But Fra Cormolithew pointed out that Samble didn't make much economic sense to begin with. There weren't any towns hereabouts, the land didn't support farming, there was little in the way of industry. He developed a theory that it was every bit as much a religious community as the monastery where we had stayed last night. And if that were the case, perhaps Estimard and Orlo didn't have to pay for things with money, if instead they could provide useful services to the townsfolk.
"Or perhaps they are simply beggars," suggested Fra Jad, "like certain orders of old."
Most of the avowed seemed more comfortable with the beggar hypothesis than with any suggestion that Estimard or Orlo might have been making himself useful to these kinds of people. It led to a lively discussion. All of our attempts to plane each other would have disturbed the service in the Ark if it had been a quiet and contemplative kind of proceeding, but it was more raucous in that place than we could ever hope to be, with a lot of singing that sounded like shouting. A few of us separated ourselves from the discussion and spent a minute looking back and forth between the Cartabla and the Butte. Samble, which Fra Cormolithew speculated might be an ancient weathered contraction of Savant Bly, stood at the beginning of a dirt road that spiraled around the Butte to its top. After a few minutes, we identified the place where that road began, the dirt lot behind the arch. And at the moment, there was no way to drive through it and get on that road. The lot was full of parked vehicles. A few shiny mobs, such as might belong to whoever passed for burgers in Samble, but mostly dust-covered fetches with big tires. There was an open lane up the center. The head of the road, though, was squarely blocked by Ganeliel Crade's fetch. According to the Cartabla, it was only 4 miles to the top, and I was feeling restless. So I filled my water bottle from a pump in the middle of the green and started to walk up the road. Leo came with me. So did Fra Criskin, who was the youngest of the hundreders. It felt a little strange walking among the parked fetches of the faithful of Samble, but once we squeezed past Crates and got onto the road, it curved around the flank of the Butte, and the little town disappeared from view. A minute after that, we were no longer able to hear the shouting inside the arch, just the rush of a dry, crackling wind coming at us from across the desert, carrying the sharp perfume of the tough resinous plants that grew down there. We gained altitude briskly and the temperature of the air dropped even as we warmed to the task. Once we had reached a point opposite to Samble, we were able to see all the way up to the top and make out a few buildings and the crippled skeletons of old aerial towers and polyhedral domes. We guessed they were military relics, which wasn't interesting since, after a few thousand years of habitation, all landscapes were strewn with such things. We spiraled up and around to a point where we could look down into Samble and wave to our friends below. The service in the arch showed no sign of winding down. We had assumed that the vehicles would catch up with us soon into our hike. In other words, we were only doing this to get some exercise, not as a way of getting to the top. But now it seemed we might get there before our vehicles did. For some reason, this aroused our competitive instincts and made us hike faster. We found a shortcut that had been used by other hikers and cut off one whole circuit of the mountain by scrambling straight up the slope for a couple of hundred feet.
"Did you know, Fra Pavlagan?"
I asked Kriskin when we had stopped at the top of the shortcut to drink water and marvel at our progress. The view was worth a few minutes.
I was his Fid, Kriskin said. You were Orlo's?
I nodded. Are you aware that Orlo was a Fid of Paphlagon before Paphlagon came to you through the labyrinth? Fra Kriskin said nothing. For Paphlagon to have mentioned Orlo, or anything about his former life among the Tenors, to Kriskin would have been a violation of the discipline. But it was the sort of thing that could easily leak out when talking about one's work. I went on.
Paphlagon and another Tenor named Estimard worked together and raised Orlo. They left at the same time, Paphlagon via the labyrinth and Estimard via the Daygate. Estimard came here,
Kriskin asked.
What was Orlo's reputation? Before his anathem, I mean.
He was our best, I said, surprised by the question. Why? What was Paphlagon's reputation?
Similar.
But, because I could tell that there was a but coming.
His avocation was a bit strange. Instead of doing something with his hands like most people, he made a hobby of studying.
We know, I said. The polycosm, and or the Hylaean theoric world.
Oh, you looked at his writings, Kriskin said.
20-year-old writings, I reminded him. We have no idea what he's been up to recently.
Kriskin said nothing for a few moments, then shrugged.
It seems highly relevant to the Convox, so I guess it's okay for me to talk to you about it.
We won't tell on you,
Leo promised him.
Kriskin didn't catch the humor.
Have you ever noticed that when people are talking about the idea of the Hylaean theoric world, they always end up drawing the same diagram?
Yeah, now that you mention it, I said.
Two circles or boxes, Leo said. An arrow from one to the other.
One circle or box represents the Hylaean theoric world, I said. The arrow starts there and points to the other one, which represents this world.
This cosmos,
Kriskin corrected me.
Or a causal domain, if you will. And the arrow represents...
A flow of information,
Leo said.
Knowledge of triangles pouring into our brains.
Cause and effect relationship, was my guess. I was recalling Orlo's talk of causal domain shear.
Those two amount to the same thing,
Kriskin reminded us.
That kind of diagram is an assertion that information about the oracle forms can get to our cosmos from the HTW and cause measurable effects here.
Hold on. Measurable? What kind of measurable are you talking about?
Leo asked.
You can't weigh a triangle. You can't pound in a nail with the Edrakonic theorem.
But you can think about those things,
Kriskin said.
And thinking is a physical process that goes on in your nerve tissue.
You can stick probes into the brain and measure it, I said.
That's right,
Kriskin said.
And the whole premise of protism is that those brain probes would show different results if there weren't this flow of information coming in from the Hylaean theoric world.
I guess that's so,
Leo admitted.
But it sounds pretty sketchy when you put it that way.
Never mind about that for now,
Kriskin said. We were on a steep part of the road, breathing hard and sweating as the sun shone down on us, and he didn't want to expend much energy on it.
Let's get back to that two-box diagram. Paphlagon was part of a tradition, going back to one Sur Uthantine at St. Beritos in the 14th century AR, that asks, why only two? Supposedly it all started when Uthantine walked into a chalk hall and happened to see the conventional two-box diagram where it had been drawn up on a slate by one Fra Erasmus.
Leo turned and looked at me.
Yes, I said. My namesake.
Kriskin went on.
Uthantine said to Erasmus, I see you are teaching your fids about directed acylic graphs. When are you going to move on to the ones that are a little more interesting? To which Erasmus said, I beg your pardon, but that's no dag. It is something else entirely. This affronted Sur Uthantine, who was a Theor who had devoted her whole career to the study of such things. I know a dag when I see one, she said. Erasmus was exasperated, but on reflection he decided it might be worth following up on his sewer's upsite. So Uthentine and Erasmus developed complex protism.
As opposed to simple? I asked.
Yes, Kriskin said. Where simple is the two-box kind. Complex can have any number of boxes and arrows, as long as the arrows never go round in a circle.
We had spiraled around to the shady side of the butte and come to a stretch of road that had been covered with silt during seasonal rains, perfect for drawing diagrams. While we rested and sipped water, Kriskin went on to give us a calca about complex protism. The gist of it was that our cosmos, far from being the one and only causal domain reached by information from a unique and solitary Hylaean theoric world, might be only one node in a web of cosmi through which information percolated, always moving in the same direction, as lamp oil moves through a wick. Other cosmi, perhaps not so different from ours, might reside up wick from ours and feed information to us, and yet others might be down wick from us, and we might be supplying information to them. All of which was pretty far out, but at least it helped me understand why Paphlagon had been evoked.
Now, I have a question for you, Tedders,
Kriskin said as we set out again.
What was Estimard like?
Well, he walked out before we were collected, I said. So we didn't know him.
Oh, that's all right, Kriskin said. We'll know soon enough.
We walked on silently for a few steps before Leo, casting a wary glance to the top of the butte, not so far away now, said,
I've been looking into Estimard a little. Maybe I should tell you what I know before we barge into his house.
Good for you.
What did you learn?
I asked.
Well, this might be one of those cases where someone walked out before he could be thrown back,
Leo said.
Really? What was he doing?
His avocation was tiles,
Leo said.
The really ornate tile work in the new laundry was done by him.
The geometric stuff, I said.
Yes, but it seems he was using that as a sort of cover story to pursue an ancient geometry problem called the Teglon. It's a tiling problem, and it dates all the way back to the Temple of Orithena.
Isn't that the problem that made a bunch of people crazy? I asked.
Metacorines was standing on the Decagon in front of the Temple of Orithena, contemplating the Teglon, when the ash rolled over him, Kriskin said.
I said, it's the problem that Rebemachis was thinking about on the beach when the Bayesian soldier ran him through with a spear. Leo said,
Sewer Charla of the Daughters of Hylaea thought she had the answer, scratched out on the dust of the road to Upper Colban when King Ruda's army marched through on their way to getting massacred. She never recovered her sanity. People's efforts to solve it have spun off entire sub-disciplines of theorics. And there are, have always been, some who paid more attention to it than was really good for them. The obsession gets passed down from one generation to the next.
You're talking of the lineage, Kriskin said.
Yes,
Leo answered, with another nervous look up.
Which lineage do you mean?
I asked.
The lineage, people call it,
Kriskin said.
Or sometimes, the old lineage.
Well, give me some help. What consensus is it based at? Kriskin shook his head.
You're assuming it's like an order. But this lineage goes back farther than the Reconstitution, farther even than Sant Cartus. Supposedly, it was founded during the Peregrine period, by Theors who had worked with Metacorines.
But who, unlike him, didn't end up under 300 feet of pumice,
Leo added.
Well, that's a whole different matter then, I said. If that's really true, it's not of the Mathic world at all.
That's the problem, Leo said. The lineage was around for centuries before the whole idea of Maths, Fras, and Sewers, so you wouldn't expect it to operate according to any of the rules that we normally associate with our orders.
You were speaking of it in the present tense,
I pointed out. Kriskin again looked uneasy, but he said nothing. Leo glanced up again and slowed.
Where is this going? Why are you guys so nervous?
I asked.
Some came to suspect that Estimard was a member,
Leo said. But Estimard was an Edharian, I said.
That's part of the problem,
Leo said. Problem? I asked. Yes, said Kriskin. For me and you, anyway.
Why, because you and I are Adharians?
Yes, Kriskin said, with a flick of the eyes toward Leo.
Well, Leo, I trust with my life, I told him. So you could say anything in front of him that you might say to me as a fellow Adharian.
All right, Kriskin said. It doesn't surprise me that you've never heard about this, since you've only been in the Order of Saint Edhar for a few months, and you're just a tenor, I said. Go ahead, I'm not offended. But I was, a little.
Behind Kriskin, Leo made a funny face that took the sting out of it.
Otherwise, you might have heard rumors about this kind of thing. Remarks. To what effect? First of all, that Adharians in general are a little nutty, a little mystical.
Of course I know some people like to say that, I said.
All right, Kriskin said. Well, then you know that one of the reasons people look askance at us Adharians is that it seems as though our devotion to the Hylaean theoric world might take precedence over our loyalty to the discipline and the principles of the reconstitution.
Okay, I said.
I think that's unfair, but I can see how some people might harbor such notions.
Leo added.
Or pretend to harbor them when it gave them a weapon to wave in Adharians' faces.
Now, Kriskin said, imagine that there was, or was thought to be, a lineage of what amounted to ultra-Adharians.
Are you telling me that people think there's a connection between our order and the lineage?
Kriskin nodded.
Some have gone so far as to lodge the accusation that the Adharians are a sham, a false front whose real purpose is to act as a host body for an infestation of Teglon worshippers.
Given the number of contributions Adharians had made to theorics over the millennia, I didn't have any trouble dismissing such a ludicrous claim. But one word caught my attention.
Worshippers?
I repeated. Kriskin sighed.
The kinds of people who spread such rumors, he began,
are the same ones who think that our belief in the HTW is tantamount to a religion, I concluded. And it suits their purposes to spread the idea that there is a secret cult at the heart of the Adharian Order.
Kriskin nodded.
Is there?
Leo asked.
I'd have slugged him if I could have gotten away with it.
Kriskin didn't know about Leo's sense of humor, and so he took it pretty badly.
What did Hestemard actually do when he was pursuing this avocation?
I asked Leo.
Was he reading books? Trying to solve the Teglon, lighting candles and reciting spells?
Mostly reading books. Very old ones,
Leo said.
Very old ones that had been left behind by others who in their day had likewise been under suspicion of belonging to the lineage.
Seems interesting, but harmless, I said.
Also, people noticed that he was unduly interested in the millenarians. During aughts, he would take notes while the thousanders sang.
How can anyone really follow the meaning of those chants without taking notes?
And he went into the upper labyrinth a lot.
Well, I admitted, that's a bit odd. Is it a part of the myth surrounding the lineage that its members violate the discipline? Communicate across the boundaries of their maths?
Yes, Kriskin said.
It fits in with the whole conspiracy theory aspect. The slur on the Adharians in general is that they consider their work to be more profound, more important than anyone else's. That the pursuit of the truths in the Hylaean theoric world takes precedence over the discipline. So if their pursuit of the truth requires that they communicate with avowed and other maths, or with extras, they have no compunctions about doing so. This was sounding more and more ridiculous by the moment, and I was beginning to think it was one of those nutty hundreder fads. But I said nothing because I was thinking about Orlo talking to Saman in the vineyard and making illicit observations.
Leo snorted. Extras? What kind of extras would care about a mystical 6,000-year-old theorics problem?
The kind we've been hanging around with the last 2 days, Kriskin said.
We had come to a complete stop.
I stepped forward up the road. Well, if everything you're saying is true, we're not doing ourselves any favors by being out here.
Kriskin took my meaning right away, but Leo looked puzzled. I went on.
Sant Tredegar is filling up with avowed from all over the world. The hierarchs must be keeping track of who has arrived, from which consent. And we, a group of mostly Edharians from, of all things, the consent of Sant Edhar, are going to be late.
Because we've been bending the rules, wandering among the Deolaters, Leo said,
beginning to get it.
Looking for a couple of wayward Fras who exactly fit the stereotype that Kriskin's been talking about.
Leo and I were at the summit a few minutes later. We had left Kriskin huffing and puffing in our wake. All of the weird talk had made us nervous, and we had practically run the rest of the way. Not out of any practical need to hurry, simply to burn off energy. The top of Bly's Butte looked as if it might have been a lovely place back in the days of Sant Bly. It existed because there was a lens of hard rock that had resisted erosion and protected the softer stuff beneath it, while everything for miles around had slowly washed down. There was enough room on top to construct a large house, say the size of the one where Jessery's family lived. A lot of different structures had been crammed onto it over the millennia. The bottom strata were masonry, stones or bricks mortared directly onto the butte's hard summit. Later generations had poured synthetic stone directly atop those foundations to make small blockhouses, guard shacks, pillboxes, equipment enclosures, and foundations for aerials, dishes, and towers. These, then, had been modified, connections between them built, worn out, demolished, or rusted away, replaced or buried under new work. The stone, synthetic and natural, was stained a deep ochre by the rust of all the metal structures that had been here at one time or another. For such a small area, it was quite complicated. The sort of place children could have explored for hours. Leo and I were not so far out from being children that we couldn't be tempted, but we had plenty else on our minds. So we looked for signs of habitation. The most conspicuous of these was a reflecting telescope that stood on a high plinth that had once supported an aerial tower. We went there first. The telescope looked in some ways like an art project that Cord or one of her friends might have made in a welding shop from scraps of steel. But looking into it, we could see a hand-ground mirror, well over 12 inches in diameter, that looked perfect. And it was easy to figure out that it had a polar axis drive, cobbled together from motors, gearboxes, and bearings, scavenged from who knows where. From there it was easy to follow a trail of evidence across the platform and down an external stairway to a lower platform on the southeast exposure of the complex. This had been kitted out with a grill for cooking meat, weatherproof poly chairs and table, and a big umbrella. Children's toys were stored with unchildlike neatness in a poly box, as if kids came up here sometimes, but not every day. A door led off this patio into a warren of small rooms, little more than equipment closets, that had been turned into a home. Whoever was living in this place, it wasn't Orlo. Judging from phototypes on the walls, it was an older man with a somewhat younger wife and at least two generations of offspring. Icons were almost as numerous as snapshots, and so this was obviously a Deolater family. We gathered these impressions over the course of a few seconds before we realized we were trespassing on someone's home. Then we felt stupid because this was such a typical avowed mistake. We backed out so fast, we almost knocked each other down. The patio was a smooth slab of synthetic stone. Given that Estimard was such a zealous tiler, it seemed odd that he had not improved it. But now we noticed a stair that led up to a ledge where he had fashioned a kiln out of burnt bricks. Around it was strewn the detritus of many years' work. Clay, molds, pots of glaze, and thousands of tiles and tile shards in the same repertoire of simple geometric shapes as those that decorated the new laundry at Edhar. Estimard hadn't got round to tiling his patio yet because he hadn't found the perfect configuration of tiles. He hadn't solved the Teglon.
Clinically insane? I asked Leo. Or just well on his way?
Kriskin came up a different way. When he found us, he mentioned that he had seen another, smaller habitation.
We followed him as he backtracked around the southern limb of the complex. We knew what it was instantly. All the earmarks of a pinprick map were plain to see. It was set off in a corner, reachable only by a long and somewhat challenging path, at the end of which stood a barrier, mostly symbolic, as it had been improvised recently from polytarps and plywood, and a gate. Passing through the gate, we found ourselves in a setting where we felt perfectly at home. It was another roofless slab. A broker of real estate might have called it a patio. We saw it as a miniature cloister. All vestiges of the secular had been carefully scrubbed away. All that remained was the ancient stained stone and a few necessaries, all handmade. A table and chair, sheltered beneath a canvas, stretched over a frame of timbers, lashed together with many turns of string. A rusty paint bucket stood in the corner, lid held down with a stone. Leo opened it, wrinkled his nose, and announced that he had found Orlo's chamber pot. It was empty and dry. The ashes in the bottom of his brazier were cold. His water jug was empty, and a wooden locker, which had once been used to store food, had been emptied of everything but seasonings, utensils, and matches. A beat-up wooden door led to Orlo's cell, which, for the most part, was done up in similar style. The clock, however, was distinctly modern, with glowing digital readouts to 1/100 of a second. Bookshelves made of old stair treads and masonry blocks supported a few machine-printed books and handwritten leaves. One wall was covered by leaves, diagrams and notes Orlo had posted there using little dabs of tack. Another wall was covered by phototypes, mostly showing various efforts that Orlo had made to capture images of the cousin's ship using, we assumed, the homemade telescope above. The typical image was little more than a fat white streak against a background of smaller white streaks, the tracks of stars. In one corner of this mosaic, though, Orlo had posted several unrelated phototypes that he had torn from publications or printed using a SynDev. At a glance, these seemed to depict nothing more than a big hole in the ground, an open pit mine, perhaps. The rest of the leaves formed an overlapping mosaic, with lines drawn from one to the next, diagramming a tree-like system of connections. The uppermost leaf was labeled Orathena. Near its top was written the name of Andracones. From it, one arrow descended vertically to the name of Dyax. This was a dead end. But a second arrow, angling down and off to the side, pointed to the name of Metachorones. And from it, the tree ramified downwards to include many names from many places and centuries.
"Uh-oh,"
Leo said.
"I hate the looks of that," I admitted.
"It is lineage stuff," put in Criskin.
The door opened, and there was violence. Not prolonged. It was finished in a second, and not severe. But it was definitely violence, and it wrenched our minds so far out of the track we had been following that there was no question of getting back to it any time soon. Simply, a man burst in through the cell's door and Leo took him down. When it was finished, Leo was sitting on the man's chest and examining, with utmost fascination, a projectile weapon that he had just extracted from a holster on the man's hip.
"Do you have any knives or anything like that?"
Leo asked, and glanced at the door. More people were approaching. The foremost of these was Barb.
"Get off of me!"
the man shouted. It took a moment for it to sink in that he was speaking in Orth.
"Give me that back."
We noticed that he was pretty old, though when he had come in the door, he had moved with the vigor of a younger man.
"Estimard carries a gun," Barb announced. "It is a local tradition. They don't consider it threatening."
"Well, I'm sure Estimard won't feel threatened by my carrying this one, then,"
Leo said. He rolled backwards off of Estimard and came up on his feet, gun in hand, pointed at the ceiling.
"You have no business in here," Estimard said. "And as for my gun, you'd better shoot me with it or hand it over."
Leo didn't even consider handing it over. Now, through most of this, I'd been so shocked, and then so confused, that I'd stood motionless. I had been afraid of doing anything for fear of doing the wrong thing, but the sight of my friends' faces outside nudged me to act, since I didn't wish to look tongue-tied or indecisive.
"Since you have just asserted we have no business here," I pointed out,
an assertion we disagree with, by the way, it would not be in our interests to supply you with weapons. By this time, other members of our Peregrine group had crowded onto the patio. Fra Jad came in, shouldered Estimard out of his way, took in the cell at a glance, and began examining the leaves and phototypes Orlo had put on the wall. This, much more than being knocked down by Leo or planed by me, made Estimard realize he was outmatched. He got smaller somehow and looked away. Unlike the rest of us, he'd only had a few minutes to get used to being in the presence of a thousander. Leo, a lot of people carry sidearms out here. It was Cord. I can see why you got the wrong idea, but take my word for it, he was not going to draw down on you. No one responded. Come on, you bunch of sad sacks. It's picnic time. Picnic? I said.
After we are finished with our service, Estimard said. We have a cookout on the green, if the weather is good.
Cord's intervention seemed to have cheered him up a little. I glanced out the door and caught the eye of Archibald, out on the patio. He raised his eyebrows. Yes, Estimard has become a Deolater. Back in the Consent, we'd always pictured pharaohs as long-haired wild men, but Estimard looked like a retired chemist out for a day hike. Estimard held me in a careful gaze.
You must be Erasmus, he said.
This seemed to settle something for him. He breathed deeply, shaking off the last vestiges of the shock he had gone into when Leo had helped him to the floor.
Yes, all of you are invited to the picnic, if you promise not to assault people.
Seeing the objection percolating through my brain towards my face, he smiled and added,
People who haven't assaulted you first, that is. And I doubt they will. They're more tolerant of avowed than you are of them.
Where's Orlo? Fra Jad, still planted with his back to us, currently viewing the phototypes of the open pit mine, startled us all by unlimbering his subsonic voice.
Orlo has gone north.
Estimard was astonished. Then the smile crept back onto his face as he figured out how the Thousander had figured this out.
Fra Jad has it right.
We shall attend the picnic,
Fra Jad announced, pronouncing the fluckish word with tweezers.
Leo Erasmus and I shall go down last, in the vehicle of Ganeliel Crade.
This directive filtered out to the patio. People turned around and headed back toward the vehicles. Leo took the ammunition magazine out of the gun and handed them back separately to Estimard, who departed, reluctantly, with Criskin. As soon as they had passed out through the makeshift gate, Fra Jad reached out and began plucking the leaves off the wall. Leo and I helped and gave all that we had harvested to Fra Jad. He left most of the phototypes alone, but took the ones that depicted the big hole in the ground and handed them to me. The Thousander went out to Orlo's cloister and stuffed all of the leaves into the brazier. Then he reached into Orlo's food locker and took out the matches.
I infer from the label that this is a fire-making praxis, he said.
We showed him how to use matches. He set fire to Orlo's leaves. We all stood around until they had turned to ash. Then Fra Jad stirred the ashes with a stick.
Time for picnic, he said.
As we spiraled down the butte, jostling and rocking in the open back of Ganeliel Crade's fetch like so many bottles in a box, we were able to look down from time to time and see the picnic taking shape down on the village green of Samble. It appeared that these people took their picnics as seriously as they did their religious services. Fra Jad seemed to have other things on his mind and said nothing until we were almost down to Samble. Then he pounded on the roof of the Fetch's cab and, in Orth, asked Crade if he wouldn't mind waiting here for a few minutes. In really wild, barbarous-sounding Orth, Crade said that this would be fine. It had never crossed my mind that someone like Crade would know our language. But it made sense. The Counterbasians distrusted priests and other middlemen. They believed everyone should read the scriptures themselves. Almost all read translations into Fluckish. But it wasn't so far-fetched to think that an especially fervent and isolated sect, such as the people of Samble, might learn classical Orth so that they would no longer have to entrust their immortal souls to translators.
Fra Jed let me know I should get out. I vaulted from the back of the fetch and then helped him down, more out of respect than anything, since he didn't seem to need much helping. We strolled about 100 paces to a bend in the road where there was an especially nice view over the high desert to the mountains of the north, still patched with snow in places and dappled by cloud shadows.
"We are just like Protus looking down over Ethras," he remarked.
I smiled, but didn't laugh. The work of Protus was viewed as embarrassingly naive by many. It was rarely mentioned except to be funny or ironic. But to deprecate it so was a trend that had come and gone 100 times, and there was no telling what Fra Jad, whose math had been sealed off for 690 years, might think of it. The more I stood and looked at him and followed his gaze northward to the clouds and the shadows that they cast on the flanks of the mountains, the more glad I became that I hadn't snickered.
"What do you think Orlo saw when he looked out thus?"
Fra Jad asked.
"He was a great appreciator of beauty and loved to look at the mountains from the Starhenge," I said.
"You think he saw beauty? Well, that is a safe answer, since it is beautiful. But what was he thinking about? What connections did the beauty enable him to perceive?"
"I couldn't possibly answer that."
"Don't answer it. Ask it."
"More concretely, what do you want me to do?"
"Go north," he said. "Follow and find Orlo."
"Tredegar is south and east."
"Tredegar," he repeated, as if waking from a dream of it. "That is where I and the others shall go after the picnic."
"I have bent the rules quite a bit by coming here," I said. "We've lost a day."
"A day? A day?"
Fra Jad, the Thousander, thought it was pretty funny that I should care about a day.
"Chasing Orlo around could take months," I said. "For being so late, I could be thrown back, or at least given more chapters."
"Which chapter are you up to now?"
5.
9,
Fra Jad said. For a moment, I thought he was correcting me. Then I was afraid he was sentencing me. Finally, I understood that he himself was all the way up to chapter 7. He must have spent years on it. Why? How had he gotten in that much trouble? Had it made him crazy? But if he was crazy or incorrigible, why had he, of all the Thousanders, been evoked? After his voco, why had his fraws and sewers sung the way they had, as though their hearts had been ripped out?
"I have a lot of questions," I said.
"The most efficient way for you to get answers is to go north."
I opened my mouth to repeat my earlier objection, but he held up a hand to stay me.
"I shall make every effort to see to it you are not punished."
It was by no means clear to me that Fra Jad would have any such power in a giant convox, but I didn't have the strength of will to tell him as much to his face. Lacking that strength, I had but one way out of the conversation.
"Fine. After the picnic, I'll go north. Though I do not understand what that means."
"Then keep going north until you understand it," Fra Jad said.